I'd like to look at two specific keynotes and to develop the themes that appear in them, and then to, from what I can tell, the themes are contrasting, if not opposing. We'll try to see how we can possibly reconcile them, if they can be reconciled. The first kina that we're going to look at is kina yudbet. If you have the keynote books in front of you, they should be around. There's no source sheet because I assume that people would have keynote books readily available. If that's not the case, then this is Echa Yashva Chavatzelet HaSharon. This is a kina of 24 stanzas. Starts Echa Yashva Chavatzelet HaSharon. I'll go with the Rosenfeld translation. Echa Yashva Chavatzelet HaSharon B'daman Ron Mipinos E Aron V'na'um Mishmerotam Kohanim b'nei Aharon, k'nimsar habayit b'misarevei maron. And then there's a word that's added in parentheses, Yeho Yariv. How lonely sits the rose of Sharon. Phil here. Phil's the rose of Sharon. Song is muted on the lips of the Levites and the priests, the offspring of Aaron, were moved away from their watch stations when the temple was delivered into the hands of the rebellious upstarts. So the word maron, the rebellious upstarts, is actually a play on words. Yehoyariv, that word in parentheses, is one of the 24 families of Kohanim that served in the Beit HaMikdash. If you look in... This is kina number 12. If you look in Sefer Divrei Hayamim, Perek Aleph, Perek Chaf Dalet, in the middle of the Perek, starting in Pasuk Zayin, you'll see that David HaMelech and Shmuel HaNavi, or David, based on the Yesod of Shmuel HaNavi, divided the Kohanim into 24 different shifts, and each shift had its leader. There was a rotation of 24 families, 24 priestly families, and each one would serve in the Beit HaMikdash for a week. And this would continue, 24, 24, 24, Now, the Beit HaMikdash, the first Beit HaMikdash, as we know, was destroyed. In the second Beit HaMikdash, the book of Ezra says, and this is in the second chapter of the book of Ezra, says that there were only four families of Kohanim that came back. Of those 24 families, only four returned. But it's not fair to take four families and make them, you know, everybody gives up 1 week a month. So it talks about, the Gemara talks about how they took those four families and divided them up into 24, that each of those four families was divided into six. And so once again, they had 24 families. And then at some point during Bayit Sheni, either some of the other groups of Kohanim came back, or those groups of Kohanim, those new 24 groups of Kohanim, just took the names of the earlier groups of Kohanim. Because in Sefer HaChashmonaim, it talks about the Chashmonim being from the family of Yehoyariv. There was no Yehoyariv. Yehoyariv was not one of the families that came back. Yehoyariv is listed first in Divrei Hayamim. Yehoyariv is not listed at all in Ezra. But the Sefer HaChashmonaim says that that the Chashmonaim were from Yehoyariv. So either some came back, Or they took the name Yehoyariv, but really they were from a different group. Or when you're the king, you get to do what you want. So if you want to make a new schedule, you make a new schedule. You make a new rotation. Now here's the interesting thing. And here's, I would even say, the crazy thing. Elazar HaKalir is writing this Kina in the 600s, approximately, in the area of Eretz Yisrael. And he's still going through these 24 families. But each family is associated with a place. Each family had a town. And each of these towns is somewhere in the Galil. So when it talks about Misarvei Maron, Maron is a play on words. The family of Yehoyariv eventually moved to the area that we know as Meron. The next one is Kohanei Tziporim. That's the family of Yedaya, and they lived in Tzipori. The family of Eliashiv lived in, here it says Elkana, they lived in the town of Kana, Kfar Kana, an Arab town today. And if you look through all of these, Kohen Kavul, it's not talking about Kabul in Afghanistan, there was a city near Haifa in the Carmel range called Kavul, Kohane Arbel. Now the Kohanim, in the time of the Mikdash, did not live in the Galil. They lived around here. They lived in Modi'in. They lived in the area around Yerushalayim because they needed to be able to get there for their Mishmarot. And it was a schlep from up north. The Kohanim had to travel. The Kohanim didn't want to have to travel. They wanted, and also they lived the rest of their lives. They were eating truma. They lived in a state of purity, and it was much easier to do that in the area around Yerushalayim because the people that traveled to Yerushalayim would make sure that they were in a state of tahara, which is why around here you find so many mikvaot, like old mikvaot. I'm talking about the ancient mikvaot. What's going on is that it was the migration, the galut. The Gemara calls it a galut. The galut from Eretz Yisrael wasn't always a galut from Eretz Yisrael. The first stages of galut were, it was a galut from Eretz Yehuda to the Galil, mainly after the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Right? It even talks about Nigla Litzipori. There was a galut to Tzipori. And it talks about the different stages of the galut of the Shekhinah and the different stages of the galut of the Sanhedrin, right? From Yavne to Usha to Beit Sha'arim to Tzipori. And it talks about that as galut. So internal displacement, we don't think about that often, but internal displacement is also a form of galut. If we're forced off of where we've been living for so many hundreds of years, and we only have to move 60, 70 kilometers north, that's still experienced as a galut. So these families of the Kohanim, they moved north. And there's a braita that was really only recently discovered in the Cairo Geniza in the last 100 years, that lists the 24 families of the Kohanim and the towns that are associated with them now. And these are the towns that correspond to what we find in Kalir, meaning Elazar HaKalir was working off of that braita. And now it gets really wild. In three different Batei Knesset that they excavated here in Eretz Yisrael, one in Tveria, one in Caesarea, and one in Ashkelon, they found these stone pillars, stone tablets that had this braita on it. In Batei Knesset. And then they found another one, a fourth one, and this is the best preserved one, in a mosque in Yemen. From the 600s, the 700s, they don't know exactly how to date it. It's not exactly easy to walk into a mosque in Yemen and start doing archaeological digs. They're touchy. But this was discovered in the early 1970s and published first in Russian. It was a Soviet scholar who first discovered it, and he published it, and then it was discussed in several volumes of Tarbetz, but they have, from what's visible, is you have about half of it, about 11 of the families of Kohanim are found on this tablet, on this stone tablet in Yemen. So you know how in shuls today you'll have a tablet on the wall that'll say, okay, today we say Mashiv HaRuach, don't forget to say Mashiv HaRuach, and don't forget to say V'sein Talu Matar, and don't forget to add Yalev Yavo, and today is the seventh day of the Omer. You have these, now they're all digitized. Now they're all, you know, they're all flat screen, you know, the Kiddush is sponsored by, and this is, you know, that's how it works today. You go upstairs and see one. Right? But we still remember the olden days when you had like a wooden luach, and they would put the, you know, Sein Talu Matar and Yalev Yavo, and don't forget to add Aneinu, and don't forget to remind people what to say. So that's what these luchot were. They had the rotation of 24 Kohanim, and it doesn't map onto the year exactly, because 24 doesn't exactly go into 52. They wanted to make sure that the Kohanim, they kept the cycle going, right? This week is the week of Yehoyarib. This week is the week of Eliashiv. I don't know, maybe the Arkings know what family they're from. Do they know what family they're from? They don't know? If the Arkings don't know, then nobody knows which family they're from. I don't know. You guys know? No. The Bentheims don't know, the Arkings don't know. Nobody knows. So they kept on every week. They would announce, and they found a nusach they would announce in shul every week, and this continued until the 11th century, meaning this continued for 1,000 years after the destruction of the Beit Hamikdash here in Eretz Yisrael, and it ends pretty much with the Crusades, which is the end of the autonomous Eretz Yisrael community. The communities that were in Eretz Yisrael after the Crusades were Ashkenazic and Sephardic communities coming from elsewhere that displaced. You know, Eretz Yisrael had its own communities with its own customs. For example, you know, they used to read the Sefer. They would finish the Torah only once every 3 years. In Bavel, they would finish the Torah every year. In Eretz Yisrael, they would read 1/3 of a parsha every week, and they would finish it every 3 years. Yeah. Why are they keeping track of the Mishmaro? We'll get to that. So Eretz Yisrael had its own customs. One of the customs was they only kept one day of Rosh Hashanah, but that ended around then. That, much to our chagrin, that would have been nice. And so this custom of announcing the Mishmarot also ends around that time, in the 11th century, the 1000s. But it continued for 1,000 years after the Churban. The question is, why? Who cares? So, there's a Gemara in which Abaye says that he never drank wine. Abaye was a Kohen. He was an orphan. He didn't know what family he was from. He didn't know which of the 24 Mishmarot he was from. And so he was concerned. Maybe the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt tomorrow. And maybe I'll be called to serve in the Beit HaMikdash tomorrow, because I don't know what family I'm from. Maybe there's a 1 in 24 chance that I'll be called on to go. And if I spend the night drinking tonight, then what, you know, I won't be able to serve tomorrow, because a Kohen who has drunk wine is not allowed to serve. So he never drank wine his entire life. This is based on an interpretation of a Tosefta. There's a Tosefta in Masechet Ta'anit that talks about how even after the Churban Bayit, any Kohen, so we talked about the division into 24. Within the 24, there was a further division into batei avot, clans. Each clan had, you know, served one day in the Beit HaMikdash. And so the Braita, the Tosefta says, and this is, the Tosefta is around the same time as the Mishnah, about 150 years after the Chorban Bayit. Anybody that knew which Beit Av they were from, they weren't allowed to drink on the day that their Beit Av would be serving. Anybody that didn't know their Beit Av but knew which family they were from, they weren't allowed to drink that entire week, the entire week that their Mishmar would be serving. Right? So the calendar of the Mishmarot continued for 1,000 years so that, you know, people still knew which families they were from, and people would still observe. We have to make sure the Kohanim we're not going to drink this week because the Beit HaMikdash might be rebuilt tomorrow, and I might be called on to serve tomorrow. So we have this calendar that continues going so that the Kohanim would know when they, so that the particular Kohanim would know when they could drink and when they couldn't drink. This is the basis for this kina. We look at it and we think of it, it's a literary convention that's very cute, that there were 24 mishmarot, and he talks about each mishmar, you know, lamenting. But for Kalir, it's a lot more than that. He's living in a world where this is still remembered. Oh, one other thing, also from the Cairo Geniza. We don't do piyutim in davening very much anymore, but this was very much a part of the Ashkenazic custom for a very long time, and it was part of the Eretz Yisrael custom before that. Kalir wrote a number of piyutim. There were other famous paitanim from Eretz Yisrael. So there's one, I can't remember the name. They discovered in the Cairo Geniza, they discovered piyutim for particular weeks based on who the Kohen was for that week. Which Kohen family was that for that week? So it wasn't just that they announced it. And by the way, when they announced it, they said, this is the week of Yehoyariv, let's say. And then they would say, Harachaman hu yachzir lanu mishmarot ha-kehuna b'mheirav yameinu, amein sela. Like we say at Svirat HaOmer, Harachaman hu yachzir lanu avodat beit hamikdash. So they would add a Harachaman like that. But it wasn't only that. We learn from these documents in the Cairo Geniza that there were special tefillot that were added for each week. There was a special, you know, they added into Shacharit, they added a special piyut about that week's family of Kohanim. So this consciousness of, not just the consciousness of, yes, there were 24 Mishmarot Kehuna, but there was an awareness of which families people came from. People knew which families they came from. And there was this sense of, I better not drink wine this week because the Beit HaMikdash could be built any minute. And I'll be called on to serve. That was a consciousness that persisted. Mehera Yibaneh HaMikdash. It could happen any minute. It could happen today. It could happen tonight. And that's something that persisted until, you know, for 1,000 years. And that's the world that Elazar HaKalir is coming from when he writes this kina. Let's turn now to kina kafchet. Az b'haloch Yirmiyahu al kivrei avot. This one is attributed to Kalir, but there are questions about whether or not this was written by Kalir. So Yirmiyahu went to the burial places of the ancestors, and he begins to have this conversation with Avraham and Yitzchak. The Imahot aren't mentioned until later. They come up only at the end. And there are four imahot mentioned. But the four imahot that are mentioned are surprising. Kol Kol b'chi Leah mitofefet al livava. Leah beating her breast sobbed bitterly. Rachel achota mevaka al baneha. Her sister Rachel wept for her children. Right, clearly a Rachel mevaka al baneha. Zilpa maka paneha. Zilpa was hitting her face, bruising her face. Bilha mekonenet b'shtei yadeha. Bilha wailed with both of her hands uplifted in grief. Shuvu tmimim l'menuchatchem. Return to your resting place, O perfect ones. Bilha and Zilpa? Where did they come from here? Talk about the Imahod, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah. Who mentioned Bilha? Who mentioned Zilpa? We talk about four Imahot. We don't talk about six Imahot. It sort of jumps out. Like where, you know, as I like to say, Bilha, I hardly know her. I actually have a client whose secretary, who I have to send the invoices to, is named Bilha, and I get a real kick out of that. So we have Bilha and Zilpa. So, okay. The question that should be asked, though, is why aren't Bilha and Zilpa considered part of the Imahot? And Bilha and Zilpa each produced two Shvatim, the same number that Rachel produced. Why aren't Bilha and Zilpa considered Imahot? And the truth of the matter is that the status of Bilha and Zilpa is something that goes back, I would say, it goes back to the Chumash itself. We know that Reuven, you know, at the end, after Binyamin is born, Reuven goes and does what he does with Bilha. According to the Pshat, he sleeps with Bilha. According to Chazal, what he did was he rearranged the beds so that Yaakov would be with Leah and not with Bilha. Yaakov, after Rachel died, his bed moved into Bilha's tent, and Reuven came and moved it to Leah's tent because he felt that it was insulting to his mother that, okay, fine, it was between Rachel and Leah, so he liked Rachel better than Leah, but now he's going to like one of the Shvachot better than he likes my mother, that I can't have, and he moves the bed into Leah's tent. And the Torah, when it talks about Bilha in that pasuk, calls her a pilegesh, a concubine. And I think that either way that you look at it, either way to understand that pasuk, whether it's according to the Pshat or according to Chazal, the whole idea is to put Bilha in her place. Right? We don't want Bilha getting too uppity. We don't want Bilha to be elevated to the status of a real wife. Leah is the one remaining true wife. Bilha, no. We can't have that. She remains a Pilegesh. But then a few psukim later, after this interlude of the family of Esav at the end of Parshat Vayishlach, starts Parshat Vayeshev. And one of the first psukim talks about Yosef, the Hunar, et b'nei Bilha, et b'nei Zilpa, nishe aviv. Vayave Yosef, et dibatam ra'a el avihem. So first of all, here, and it's talking from Yosef's perspective, it's v'hunar b'nei bilha v'b'nei zilpa nishei aviv. This is the only time in Chumash that the shvachot are elevated to the status of wife, nishei aviv. They're his father's wives. And in fact, according to, there are different midrashim as to what exactly was the dipa. What did Yosef say about the brothers? What did Yosef report to the brothers about? What did report to Yaakov about the brothers? And one of the interpretations, based on this juxtaposition in that pasuk, is that they're treating the Bnei HaShvachot like avadim. They're treating the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah as though they're slaves. And there's actually one medrash that I found that Yosef was wrong, that Yosef misinterpreted what they were doing, and therefore he himself was sold into slavery as a midah keneged midah. But I think that there is definitely something, like they didn't, that Yosef does see some, he perceives some sort of problematic in the way that the brothers are relating to the Bnei HaShvachot. And then, a few psukim later, Yosef has a dream. And in this dream, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars are all bowing down to Yosef. And Yaakov, he hears this dream, and he responds to Yosef, Havo navo, ani v'imcha v'achecha lishtachavot lecha arza. Am I and your mother and your brothers, are we going to go and bow down to you? Obviously not, for one very, very clear reason. Yosef, your mother's dead. Your mother's not bowing down to anyone. Your mother's dead. Havo navo, ani v'imcha v'achecha lishtachavot lecha. Arza. And it's already been pointed out that if you look at the psukim, the words before that, ma ha-chalom hazeh asher chalamta. What's this dream that you dreamed? Havo navo anivim. And if you look at the letters, asher chalamta havo, right, which is, that's consecutive in the Torah, the last letter of asher, resh, chalamta chet lamid, mem taf, and then havo, hey, Rachel Meita. Rachel's dead. Havo navo anivim chava achachel ishtachavot lecha arza. So what's this dream? And Rashi already comments, Yaakov misinterpreted it. Who's the moon? The moon is Bilhah. Bilhah, who raised Yosef, is the moon. Yaakov and Kal v'chomer, the brothers, couldn't imagine Bilhah representing, the moon representing Bilhah. This is, you know, you have the sun is Yaakov, and you have the moon. Okay, I can understand that the moon would be Rachel, but that the moon would be Bilhah? They can't fathom it. And there are other midrashim that talk about the special relationship that Binyamin and Yosef had with Bilhah, that she became their surrogate mother, that Yaakov, at the end of his life, when he wanted to communicate something to Yosef, he would send Bilhah as the go-between. And there are very, very few midrashim. One in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, one in Esther Rabbah, one in Bamidbar Rabbah, that talk about Sheish Imahot. That talk about this idea that there are six mothers. That Bilhah and Zilpah are counted amongst the Imahot. Now, I want to suggest that this struggle between Yosef, that Yosef, who's sort of Bilhah's champion, has a fight with the Bnei Leah over this particular issue. We saw that Reuven was the one that wanted to make sure that Bilhah remained in her place. And we see that Levi and Yehuda both represent pedigree. We talked about the pedigree of the kehuna. We talked about the pedigree of these, remembering where you're from and remembering your lineage, and I'm not going to drink wine tonight because I'm of such a lineage. That's a Levi perspective. And Yehuda is the progenitor of Malchut Beit David. Yehuda is the progenitor of the Davidic dynasty, which is, it's all about pedigree. It's all about a dynastic consciousness. So I would suggest, and then on the other side you have Yosef. What is Yosef, right? What does Yosef do? Yosef, he's sold into slavery, and he rises to be second in command of all of Egypt with no pedigree, not based on any sort of, he wasn't born into any of it. He rose from being the lowliest slave to being the number two man in the entire country. And if you look at how Yosef names his children, it very much reflects this. Menashe ki nashani Hashem et Beit David. I forgot my father's house. I forgot my pedigree. Who needs pedigree? It's a pure meritocracy. I got to where I am with God's help or on merit. I needed no pedigree. Ephraim ki Yifrani Hashem be'eretz nochriya. I was able to be fruitful. I was able to multiply in a land that's not my land. And so you have the struggle over the status of the Shvachot, the struggle over the status of the Bnei HaShvachot, is a struggle between two worldviews. One worldview where each human being on their own is of intrinsic worth. It doesn't matter who they're born to. It doesn't matter who their father was or their mother was or their grandfather or grandmother. Things should be purely meritocratic. And you have this other consciousness where remembering your pedigree, remembering who your father was and who your grandfather was, that this is the way. This is the way that things should be. And I think you have that contrast in these two keynotes that we've been discussing. That in the kina about the Chavdalid Mishmarot Kehuna, you have, as we said, people remembering for 1,000 years after the Churban what families they're from. And they can trace themselves back to, I'm the son of X, who's the son of Y, who's the son of Z, back, all the way back to Eliashiv, or to Yehoyariv, or to Bilga. Or to Yeshevav. And then you have, in this other Kina, in Kina Chavchet, you have Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah that are all crying together. As four sisters, as four mothers. And here there's an equation between Rachel and Leah on one hand and Bilhah and Zilpah on the other hand. And if you want to think about it in these terms, right, we know of the nevuot of Yechezkel and the nevuot of Ovadia that sort of see this struggle between, they take Yehuda as the representative of the Bnei Leah and Yosef as the representative of the Bnei Rachel, and that their struggle is a certain, there's something cosmic about their struggle. Right, that Yechezkel was told to take two pieces of wood, one called Eitz Yehuda, one called Eitz Yosef, v'hayula achadim bi'adecha. He was somehow supposed to bring them together. Right? That this is what we have to bring together in order for the geula to happen. That we have to somehow find some kind of way to accept the Yosef approach of the pure merit approach and the Yehuda approach of the pedigreed dynastic approach, v'hayula achadim bi'adecha. Right, the idea of you have a Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David, that we think about the Geula in these terms. And I'm going to end with it's not a Midrash, it's a Braita in Masechet Sofrim. Masechet Sofrim was composed in the 800s, the 900s. It's kind of mysterious. It's written as a Masechet Mishnayot, but it's much, much later. So at the tail end of Masechet Sofrim, you have a I'll read it inside or on my phone. This is Masechet Sofrim, Perek Chaf Aleph, Halacha Tet. It says, Tani, they taught a braita. Ma asa Yaakov Avinu kishehiviu banav et haktonet bidam. Yaakov's sons brought Yosef's bloody coat. What did he do? Lo ha'amin lahem. He didn't believe it. Kol ikar. He didn't believe them at all. Minayin. And how do we know that? Dichtiv vayimayin lehitnecham. Yaakov refused consolation. Because you don't accept comfort, you don't accept consolation for somebody who's still alive. And then it goes further. Avel shemeid humei atzmo mishtakach min halev. Avel shemeid humei atzmo mishtakach min halev. Humei atzmo mishtakach min halev. Shneemar nishkachti kimeit mi lev. When somebody dies, then when we lose a loved one, they slowly, over time, we forget them. And Yaakov couldn't forget Yosef. And he took this as a sign that Yosef was still alive. So he wanted to prove it to himself. Me'asa, what did he do? Halach beharim. He went into the mountains, v'chatzav shneimasar avanim. And he sculpted 12 stones, v'hemidan shura, put them in a row. V'katav al kol achat v'achat shem shivto, shem mazalo, shem yirecho. On each one, he wrote the name of a shevet, and the name of its mazal, right, the zodiac sign, and the name of its month. Ruvain, Teleh, Nisan, etc. V'chein kol evan v'evan. Then he said, Hitchil mishim'on. V'amar lehu, he said to the stones, Gozrani alechem sheta'amdu l'ruvain. V'lo amdu. L'shim'on, lo amdu. He said to all of them, I want you all to stand up for Ruvain. None of them did. Stand up for Shimon. None of them did. Kevan shehizkir lahem shem Yosef, but when he mentioned the name of Yosef, miyad amdu v'karu, they all stood up and bowed down to Yosef. So it's almost like Yaakov is reenacting Yosef's dream. V'adayin lo barur hadavar lo, but he still wasn't convinced. He still wasn't completely convinced. Shehu chai. Od halachu bala'u uvachan ba'alumot. Kedat harishon. He did the same thing, but with sheaves of grain. Right, so this is right out of Yosef's dream, and the same thing happened. Shemot ha-shvatim, ha-mazalot, ha-chodashim, ha-mar lehem, gozrani aleichem, she-tishtachavu. They didn't stand up for any of the brothers. They only stood up for Yosef. But Yaakov still wasn't convinced. Va'adayin lo nitbarer kol ikar shehu chai. Ella, what was it that eventually that convinced Yaakov that Yosef was still alive? He says, Ella min ha-mishmarot. It was proven to him from the mishmarot. El yashiv kohen el kana. So there's one girsa that says, El yashiv, God will return Yosef. Kohen el kana, shekana potifar. That he was bought, that the kana represents that he was bought by Potifar. Because it says, Yosef, Hurad Mitzrayma by Ikneu Potifar. So what's happening here? First of all, the first two, Yaakov does something. He acts something out. And here, it's not talking about Yaakov acting something out. How does Yaakov hear about the Mishmarot Kehuna? First of all, the fact that Yaakov is hearing, that Yaakov knows about the Mishmarot Kehuna, I mean, it's wildly anachronistic. But it seems as though Yaakov has to see something, right? So Masechet Sofrim, which is composed here in Eretz Yisrael at some point during the Tkufat HaGaonim, you could still walk into any Beit Knesset and see Luach with all of the Mishmarot Kehuna. And that's exactly what it would say. It would say, El Yashiv Kohen El Kana, Yehoyariv Kohen Meron, etc., etc. So Yaakov walks into Shul, as it were, and he sees on the Luach, he sees on the board, Eliashiv, Kohen Kana. And he says, ah, that means Yosef's coming back, because Eliashiv, God, will return. Kohen Kana, the Yosef who was bought by Potiphar. And it doesn't go further, but it seems that so Yaakov sees symbolism for Yosef in all 24 Mishmarot Kehuna. And this really brings together everything that we've said. It remains paradoxical. How does Mishmarot Kehuna prove it to Yaakov more than the other miraculous ordeals that he did? But here you have Yosef is sold into slavery because he's the one who's championing the Bnei Ashvachot. Yosef et dibatam ra el avihem. He's championing the Bnei Ashvachot. He's the one that's saying that there can't be hierarchy here. There can't be that Bilhah and Zilpah are sidelined and Leah is higher and the Bnei Leah and the Bnei Rachel are higher than the other ones. That can't be. And Yosef gets sold into slavery for this. And Yaakov, and we suggested that the Geula comes only when the Yosef approach and the Yehuda and Levi approach somehow are la'achadim bi'adenu. And here we see Yaakov, he's convinced that Yosef is still alive. Why? Because he sees the persistence of the pedigreed approach. Right, of the Kohanim that remember 1,000 years later, 700 years later, that they're from this family, and they trace themselves all the way back to Aaron HaKohen. So I think that in some level, these two trends, these two impulses that we see reflected in these two keynote, are something that they're both necessary. How they fit together, I think that's really what we have to be working out. I don't have the answer to that, but I think that the paradox is there. And the paradox is there for us to think about, and to think about how we got here and how we're going to get out.